from stpetecatalyst.com.
Hello again, Bill DeYoung here, and welcome back to the Catalyst Sessions for another fabulous Thursday. My guest today has read 18 novels. She is a New York Times best-selling writer of crime fiction and psychological thrillers, and she lives in the Tampa Bay area. What could be cooler than that, you ask? I don't know, but we have Lisa Unger here with us today. Hello, Lisa.
Hi, Bill. How's it going?
It's going all right. Well, you know, all things considered.
All things considered, right. It's a kind of a fraught question these days.
I want to start with something completely out of context.
Okay, cool.
And it will be hopefully made clear soon. Okay. I understand you hear voices.
I do.
I've heard you say that you work without an outline and you wait for the characters to say, this is where I want to go. This is where I need to go. Is that an oversimplification, or is that how it works?
Well, you know, it's slightly oversimplified. It's maybe not the entire story. So for me, every novel starts kind of with a germ, right? It might be anything. It might be a line of poetry. It could be a news story. And in one case, it was a piece of junk mail. And whatever the thing is, it leads me to have like sort of an obsession with a specific topic, generally speaking. Yeah. And then I wind up doing a lot of research into that topic because I'm just kind of an information junkie. That's just the way I've always been. So then the best way I can describe it is that if it then connects with something maybe larger that's going on within me, then I do start to hear voices or a voice, depending on the book. And that voice is the voice or the voices that I follow through my narrative. So I write without an outline. Mm-hmm. When I first sit down with this voice in my head, I don't, you know, I'm not sure who's going to show up. I'm not sure what's going to happen day to day. I'm not 100% sure what the book is about. And I certainly don't know how it's going to end.
Well,
How
interesting is that? That, you know, and the Stranger Inside, I think, is the one that sort of multiple personalities or it's a psychological thing. And you said this in another interview, too. How do you know that one of those voices isn't going to take over and take your story in a place you don't want to go?
Yeah, I mean, it's some kind of union between those things, right? It's sort of some union between like a magical element, something that I feel like happens outside of me, and a craft that I have been, you know, working on since I was a kid. I mean, I've been writing since I was a kid. I've been a reader since I was, you know, before I was a writer. And my entire education was focused on writing and literature. So in a very true way, not only, you know, do I just have this kind of dark and like sort of wild imagination, I also have this craft that I have worked on my entire life. So it's almost a little bit, exactly. It's a little bit like having a chair and a whip, you know, like you've got all this like nebulous, like wild stuff that takes place in your imagination, in your head. And you're like, okay, now let's get into line and do what we need to do. And in a very real sense, you know, I write for the same reason that I read, because I want to know what's going to happen to the people living in my head.
What does working without an outline do for you? You're not the first novelist to tell me that. And I completely respect that, because I hate doing outlines of anything. I think that comes from going to school for years and years in Florida, and they beat that out of me, you know. But what does that do for you? Does that mean that it literally can go anywhere?
I don't know what it does. I don't know that it actually does anything for me. I mean, I know that writers fall into two specific camps. There are people that write the way I write, and people that, you know, very meticulously outline everything. Mm-hmm. Character sketches, they know what every chapter is going to be. All I know is that I could not write that way. I do a little author talks thing on Friday mornings with some friends of mine, and we talk about various topics, and this is one of the topics that came up. It's, you know, plotters versus what they call in the industry pantsers. Mm-hmm. Like people who are, you know, supposedly like sort of flying by the seat of their pants, which I you know, take umbrage with. It's certainly not a flying by the seat of your pants type of thing. It's more like
slightly less sloppy. Yeah.
Right. It's more like you're a gardener. There's a seed and it grows and that you attend to that. So sure. I don't think the process is very different. It's just that my process takes a lot longer and is, you know, is sort of organic. Whereas, you know, with the plotters, and plenty of people do this to great success, you know, they just have like they have a scaffolding, they have an outline, they have, they know where things are going to go. But I don't think the two things are as different as they seem on the surface.
Well, having the craft and the ability to know how to make something helps, right? So it doesn't get out of hand. I mean, how much stuff do you discard along the way? Like, that didn't work. Are you pretty good right now at streamlining and knowing where you're going right away?
Well, so it's more like, you know, so I'm writing and, you know, I'll have this voice in my head. I'll have this real clear sense of, you know, like an energy or vibe, and I'm sitting down and I'm writing and things evolve in the writing. And then eventually at some point in the creative day, you just kind of run into like a stone wall. Like either it's your own ignorance or your brain energy just kind of winds down, or you just don't know what you're going to do next. And it's a hard stop. So when that happens, I generally I do something else. You know, I'm going to go throw in a load of laundry, or I'm going to go for a walk, or I'm going to do sit-ups. Not anything like intellectual or like social media or anything like that. Just like something else that kind of takes me out of the space and, you know, kind of frees me up, you know, some kind of simple mental task. And then I'm going to feel, until I feel the next, you know, footholder, place, thing,
it'll energy, come to you, right?
Sound, yeah. Sentence, whatever it is, I'll hear it and then I go. And so I wait, but I wait for that. So I don't just force it. Like, I'm not sitting like from the outside looking in trying to make something happen. Mm-hmm. I'm just allowing it to evolve. So when I get to the end of a draft, a first draft, which generally takes like 9 to 12 months, mm-hmm. I'm about structure wise. I'm about 95% where I want to be.
I think it's interesting that you refer to social media as an intellectual pursuit. I might take.
Oh, no, I didn't mean it that way.
It was lumped together the way you said it.
No, I didn't. No, let me go back. I definitely did not call social media an intellectual pursuit, but it does drain your brain energy.
Yeah.
And it's for a creative. To switch out of the creative mind to do the shallow work of social media, that is very easy to do because your brain's like, "Ooh, I need a dopamine rush. I want some candy." Like your brain's happy to go there. Like, "Oh, let me check my email."
I need a dopamine rush.
Right? Yeah. Like your brain's very happy to go there because it's tired, right, from creating, and then, but it's almost impossible to go back. So for me, compartmentalizing the creative space and the social media space is critical.
Let's talk biography for a second. I guess I read that you essentially grew up in New Jersey. Is that close enough?
Close enough, yeah. Okay. It's a little bit longer. I was born in Connecticut. My dad worked for Exxon, so we traveled a lot. So I lived for about 4 years in the UK and in another few years in the Netherlands. And then I went to middle school and high school in New Jersey.
And you said you were a reader and you've been writing from a young age, but I'm interested in when and how this particular genre of fiction writing, you know, wrapped its sweaty hands around your golden throat. I don't know. Okay. When did it, this is what I want to do. Were you always fascinated by this kind of writing?
Yeah. I mean, I've always just had this really sort of dark and twisted imagination. I mean, ever since I was a kid, you know, I've always like been the kid that want, you know, like I've always been the kid that just kind of wanted all the answers to everything, like every layer, even the dark stuff. And, you know, I'm very, very curious. Like, I live in the light. Like, I've always lived in the light. There's no, you know, there's no trauma or, you know, abuse or anything especially dark about, you know, my childhood, like possibly just the most banal, like family dysfunction or whatever, but like no more than anybody.
I got one of those. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, Mom. And I, but I just, you know, I've always had this really, really tremendous fascination with the dark side of human nature. And also, you know, just with psychology as well, you know, I've always been just very curious about what makes people, you know, do what they do. And so the books, more than, you know, just being dark, I mean, it's all very psychological suspense and certainly they are dark, but really every book represents a question that I have about the human mind, about the human psyche. And that's where my curiosity lies. Like, I want to know what makes one person a hero and what makes another person a killer. And, you know, are we, is it nature? Is it nurture? Is it some, you know, impossibly complicated helix of both of those things? And that's what I do. I mean, it, I work those questions out on the page.
Okay, so how did that lead into writing? I mean, why aren't you a psychologist now or a detective?
Right. I know, that's what I always think. I maybe I missed my calling. I think I should have been a...
Well, you know, 26 languages, you're doing pretty good.
No complaints. Yeah. I was a writer first. I was a writer, you know, I don't remember a time in my life before I was a writer. I know there is a time, but I don't remember that time. So this is just who, it's just who I am. I've never been anything else. I've never wanted to do anything else with my life except for this.
Angel Fire was your first book. Am I getting that right?
Yes. Angel Fire was my first book. And I started that book when I was 19.
19. Okay. Yeah. So I've got your biography tattooed in here somewhere. So, or some parts of it, let's say. So 19, you started that, but it took a while to get, but you worked in publishing. Were you a reader? What was your history in publishing before the book came out?
So I've always been a reader as well. Reader and writer. Like, my mom was a librarian, so.
I meant for a publishing house, you know, reading.
Oh, them. Yeah. No, I was actually a book publicist for publishing. So
wow.
I was like on the other side of it. So I was the one who's like booking book tours and traveling with authors and throwing parties and all that.
A thankless job, Lisa.
A thankless. Yeah. not a terrible job in your 20s living in New York City.
Sure.
Pretty sweet. But I was a writer first. You know, I started my first novel when I was still in college. And, you know, I just, when I graduated from college, like, to be honest, I just didn't really have the confidence to try to pursue that. And mainly it was because, you know, my dad basically said, you know what, that's not a job. Like, people don't do that. Like, it's nice that you can, you know, string a few coherent sentences together, but you need to, like, when you graduate from college, you're off the payroll, go to work,
Right. Don't
move home and write your novel. Right. I was
you're still writing your little stories, Lisa?
Still writing, honey? Yes, yeah, right.
Yeah. Been there, done that. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So I am, you know, so I figured, you know, publishing was kind of the closest thing I could do to following my dreams without actually following my dreams. So I started working in publicity at a publishing company. And, you know, unfortunately for me, I was extremely good at my job. And so my job just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And the time I spent writing got, you know, smaller and smaller and smaller until I wasn't writing at all. And so I had this kind of moment in my life, you know, I'd been working in publishing for almost 10 years. And in a lot of ways, I think, you know, those years were so instructive for me, but mainly it kind of gave me permission to be who I was. It was like, you know what, actually, this is a job and people are doing this and I think I can do it too. And so
that's a good education for you.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's come in, it's been so valuable to me in so many different ways as a published author. But I, you know, I had this moment in my life where I was like, okay, everything is wrong. Everything about my life is wrong. I mean, I was in the wrong relationship. I'm sure everybody knows about a little bit about that.
Sure.
And I was devoting 110% of myself to a job that I didn't love. And that the only thing I ever wanted in my life, I was just kind of letting it fade to nothing. And I figured, you know, I could live with sort of spectacular crash and burn failure, but I wasn't going to be able to live with a slow fade to black. So that was the day that I started to get serious about my writing. And I was like, I'm writing every day until I finish this novel that I started when I was 19 years old.
So how many, I don't know, what's the question? How many rejection letters did you get before somebody said, this is great, we want to put it out?
Well, so I finished the novel, which is what everybody has to do, right? You have to finish your book. You know, that's the one thing that, like, you know, everyone's like, how do I get published? It's like, have you written anything? No. Okay. Well, you need to go back to that space and finish your book. So I did finish my book. And then
I found starting to be harder than finishing.
Yeah.
Starting in the first, because I wrote some nonfiction stuff and just, I'm terrible. I'll never finish this. And, you know, and then, but somehow I did. Anyway, I'm sorry. So yeah, so you finally finished it. And
yeah, you finally finished it. And then, so I sent it, I sent it off to my five top choice agents. Yeah. By this point, I had already, you know, I had met my husband at a place called, we all know it, Sloppy Joe's in Key West.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And we had kind
of famous pickup joint, Lisa.
Yeah, exactly. Famous pickup joint. But, you know, I think it's going to work out. That was like 20 years ago.
So yeah, I guess so.
Good. Yeah. So we, you know, we had moved. I had left New York City. We had moved to Florida. I was doing some freelance public relations writing. And I got signed on pretty quickly by one of my top choice agents. And then there were several rejections, not that many. I did eventually sell that first book that I wrote when I started when I was 19. And she brokered a 2-book deal for me with St. Martin's Press. And I've been publishing a book a year. I mean, you know, the abridged version. I've been publishing a book a year ever since. So, yeah.
Oh, my God. Tom, have you lived in Florida? I mean, been here as a resident. And why are you in the Tampa Bay area specifically?
When Jeff and I decided we were getting married and we were going to start our life together, yeah. I was kind of ready to leave New York. And we just decided to go wherever he got the best job. Uh-huh. And it just happened to be here. A friend of his had a company down here. And we moved down here for him to work and for me to just kind of, you know, I had sold my apartment in Brooklyn Heights. And I said, okay, I'm giving myself 1 year to sell the book that I wrote and to write another one. And so that was my grand plan. As you can imagine, my father was not impressed.
You've done all right for yourself, kid.
I've done all right. Yeah.
So, I don't know, the publishing, from your perspective, has this whole thing kind of gone the way, I mean, you've been very successful, which is apparently nice from what I understand. But has this kind of gone the way you'd expected it to? I mean, you literally work from home anyway.
Right.
So, I mean, this whole thing of like, you know, I have 18 books out, I'm pretty successful. I'm beloved and all that stuff. You got some dough put away. It's just like, yeah, this is what I thought it would be.
You know, that's such a great question. I don't know that I ever thought I was going to get as far as I have gone.
Really?
And I think that the reason why is because, you know, I did work in publishing for 10 years. And so when I walked in as a first-time author, you know, with a small advance and a small deal on a book that was published small, that was like sort of my entry level into publishing.
Yeah.
I just knew that it was harder to succeed as a published writer than it is to get published in the first place, which is always like kind of a discouraging thing, I think, to say, but it is actually true. And so I kind of knew that walking in. I was like, okay, so I think most people see their publishing contract as like a windfall or like the end to the story. But I knew that it was an open door to the writing life. And that if I wanted to walk through that door, I would have to just roll up my sleeves and get to work and work as hard at this as I would work at anything else that I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And so I walked in, you know, knowing that the deck was stacked against me and that I was just going to have to, you know, just stay focused on the work, make sure I was writing the best book I could write every single time, and, you know, and participating in the, you know, the marketing and promotion of the books as well, which I was able to do because I came from a publicity background. Not everybody does that.
You understand how important that part of it is. Sure.
It's very important.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, but it is. Yeah. And so I kind of walked into it like, okay, I'm in the door, time to get to work. And so I never really projected myself into the future. Like, I didn't come to writing because I wanted to be a huge bestseller, because I had some dream of fame or some, like, sort of, you know, ideal of what kind of a writer I wanted to be. All I wanted to do was write. I always had these stories and these people in my head, and all I've ever wanted to do was tell those stories. And so even now, you know, I'm just kind of grateful every day that I get to do that, you know, that's my job. And that to me feels like a blessing.
Is the work harder than you thought it would be? Obviously it's, people think, oh, writer, it's like, you know, you're a musician. It's like, oh, what a nice life. You know, you're working. You're literally working. Is it? I mean, how disciplined are you? You're writing every day at a specific time of day?
Yeah, mainly. I mean, this is a job, and writing is a, you know, there's a lot of, like, sort of, you know, romance about, like, the idea of the writer that you
need
for your inspiration.
You're Colin Firth in Love, Actually. You're sitting by a little pond in France or wherever it is, and flowers. And
which, that would be great.
You alcohol or coffee or whatever. Yeah.
I can totally sign up for that, but it's more like, you know, there is a discipline and a craft. I mean, it's a book a year. Those books don't write themselves. You know, that's a journey and a relationship every single year. It's a relationship every single day. I do write early in the morning. You know, I find that, you know, my golden creative hours are from 5 a.m. to noon. And that is my space in the world to be creative. Although, of course, I write, you know, whenever I need to write or however I need to write. But that's what's best for me. And, you know, I will say that, you know, I actually live for the blank page. You know, there is nothing in my life other than, you know, sort of my family, my daughter, my husband, our time together. There is nothing in my life that gives me more joy than writing. And it was my first love, and it continues to be something that, you know, not only do I love, but that it's I'm constantly kind of in the beginner's mind with it. You know, I always believe that today I can be better than I was yesterday. I always believe that. And I never want to lose that, because there's so much energy in that and so much, like, you know, I don't know, like electricity in that idea that I can be better today than I was yesterday just because I sat down to do the work.
What happens though if you sit down at 5 a.m. with your cup of coffee and the blank page mocks you and says, you know, I got nothing today. Has that ever happened?
You sit there with it until it yields. You don't get to get up. No, you don't. When you set your creative time and the blank page is mocking you, you just stare it down until it gives you what you want.
You are disciplined. Listen, we just got a couple of minutes left. I read on your website you have a new one coming out in October.
October.
Okay, yeah. And it's called Confessions on the 7:45. So, hey, I think I see a galley.
Oh, you want one? I'll send you one.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Let's stay on here and I'll tell us about it.
I'll tell you a little bit about it. I haven't even started talking about it yet, but I'll do that now. So Confessions on the 7:45 is very loosely based on the idea from Strangers on a Train.
Yeah.
So the idea that two people meet at an exact moment in time, and that a secret is exchanged. A young woman gets on the train. She's had a terrible day. She sits next to another woman who seems vaguely familiar. And there's a connection. The train stalls. And the other woman starts up a conversation with a confession. In this space where these two women are connected and the train is dark, the young woman who got on the train also shares her darkest secret. And then they part ways. The young woman's embarrassed. Why did I do that? Why did I tell my darkest secret to a complete stranger on a train? But she did, and she hopes, maybe I'll never see this person again. But she will.
She will. Okay. This wasn't inspired by a piece of junk mail, I'm guessing.
No, not this one.
Wow, I'm intrigued. I definitely, well, of course I want to read this.
I should hope so.
It is, oh my gosh, it's time to say goodbye, Lisa Unger. Such a pleasure speaking to you.
So great to talk to you, Bill. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming on. And The Stranger Inside is out now. And if we were allowed to be on the beach and read, I'm sure people would be reading it on the beach.
Yeah.
Assume we may not be again, from what I understand. But go on with that, because this is a wonderful writer. And God, thanks again. I don't know what else to say, but thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I hope we get to meet outside of all this one of these days.
Yeah, in real life, it shouldn't be too hard, right? We should be able to get together at some point in the near or distant future, I hope.
Once you start doing the massive rounds of publicity for Confessions on the 7:45, then we'll see you out there. So, Lisa Unger, once again, thank you so much. I'm going to tell everyone that David M. Jenkins from Jobsite Theater will be back with us on Friday to talk about the Juneteenth Theater Project, which is going on this weekend. And so until then, I'm Bill DeYoung. Lisa Unger, have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you.
See you soon. Bye-bye.
From stpetecatalyst.com.